You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Lucy Anderson.
Hi, Kate Anderson.
And this is Studio 360.
My father always would travel the extra mile for his kids.
My father had a wonderful way on stage.
Shake hands, will you, Dad?
Out my hand.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, a photographer's young son concocts the stories behind the pictures.
I got to see my dad's world, and I think his feelings, they don't control his art, but they affect it.
And a young writer has mixed emotions about being the subject of her father's paintings.
I remember how he accentuated my underbite, a feature I was teased about in school and later had corrected.
My guest is the performer Bobby McFerrin.
The moment you become a father, everything changes. Even the things that your kids might not even know about you. You know, the stuff that's yours.
That's all ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. The world can be divided into people who divide everyone into categories and people who don't. Obviously, I'm in the first group. And since it's Father's Day, I decided to categorize fathers. Fathers as they're depicted in plays and movies and on TV. American culture provides four basic father types. First, the wimps. The wimpy father became a real staple in the 1950s. The wimp dad emerged just as the country took its sudden, single-minded shift to focus on rambunctious youth, the invention of the modern teenager. Kids ruled, and so dad receded. On TV, Ozzie Nelson, the perpetually smiling father of rock stars, turned the cardigan sweater into classic American wimp wear.
Here's Ozzie.
I literally cannot wear a cardigan today as a result. The most magnificently tragic wimp dad was James Dean's pathetic father in Rebel Without a Cause, played by Jim Backus.
Will you hold it?
You can't protect me.
Do you mind if I try? Do you have to slam the door in my face? I try to get to him. What happens?
Next, there's dad as jerk. Tragic jerks like Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman.
Shake hands, will you, Dad?
Not my hand. May you rot in hell if you leave this house.
And mostly jerks with a heart of gold, who've ranged from Archie Bunker to Bernie Mac on television to Robert Duvall's remarkable Great Santini.
I know it's rough to leave your friends and move every year, but you are Marine kids and can chew nails while other kids are sucking cotton candy.
Then there's the truly good father, the strong, steady, wise man. And in their bland, generic form, this was the iconic 50s sitcom dad. Like Robert Young as the preternaturally happy father on Father Knows Best. But by far the most exemplary fathers are single. And the golden age for perfect single dads was a very specific moment. The early 1960s, weirdly before the divorce epidemic. Back when single parenting was uncommon and single fatherhood unheard of. I'm talking about Chuck Connors as the rifleman and John Forsythe as bachelor father. And even more, I'm talking about the best, wisest, most lovable TV dads of all. Fred McMurray on My Three Sons and Andy Griffith in Mayberry.
If I ever catch a certain little boy handcuffing another little boy to a flagpole, he'll not only be a planting spinach, he'll be eating it standing up.
All those great dads without a mother in sight. It may be that all the male writers and producers of 50s television were working out some anti-Oedipal fantasy with their glut of single dad shows. But then I think of the ultimate ideal circa 1960 father, created by a female novelist. If you combine Fred McMurray's My Three Sons Dad with Andy Griffith's Sheriff Taylor, you get a kind, rock-steady, jacket-and-tied Southern seeker of justice.
Oh, Adam,
Wait a minute.
You get Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee.
You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view.
This is the father I wanted, and pretty much had. This is the father I want to be. Although these days, that kind of charming, confident, deeply reassuring father is considered implausible, or maybe just uninteresting. Which is why the culture's two most beloved TV fathers are a new type, the buffoon.
English? Who needs that? I'm never going to England.
One of them entirely unreal.
Don't!
And the other...
I love you all. I love you more than life itself. You're all f***ing mad.
The other, our 21st century neo-Ozzy...
Can you get this f***ing this television to work?
Shockingly real. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. We'll talk a lot more about fathers in a few minutes, but first, today on Design for the Real World, a designer talks about his original inspiration. Chalo Colina is a designer for a private space program. His love affair with structural engineering came from a gift he got when he was a teenager, a bicycle.
For Christmas, my mom got me a bicycle, which was really hard to find because I was already 6 feet 9 inches tall. Being on a bicycle just took away a lot of the negative characteristics of living in an unusually big body. I mean, I no longer felt slow. I no longer felt awkward. I mean, at that time, I wouldn't cross the street on foot if I could go on my bicycle instead. It was like an attachment to my body, and I felt like sort of a, you know, centaur of sorts, propelled with superhuman strength and power.
Bicycle, bicycle, bicycle. I want to ride my bicycle, bicycle, bicycle. I want to ride my bicycle.
Banana seats are cool. The banana seat allowed more leg extension than an ordinary seat. It allowed manufacturers to get away with fewer basic frames to fit a larger range of sizes of kids. But as a side effect, by putting the center of gravity of the rider so far back on the bicycle, it made it very easy to wheelie these bikes. Under anything more than modest pedaling loads, the front wheel just picks up. Banana seats, let's just say, became a feature of the coolest bikes and the bikes with the coolest kid riders. Because of that, there's sort of a cult of style that includes banana seats and sissy bars and, I don't know, tassels and glitter that are some pretty interesting bikes. They talk about maladies like chopper crotch, which is a banana seat inflicted injury from putting in too many miles on a seat that foul and uncomfortable. I believe that things that are right from a design standpoint look right. There's a harmoniousness to the visual quality of a machine that has had all its problems solved a long time ago. And bicycles are just like that, no matter what ornamentation you may or may not add to that. And that's a tremendously elegant piece of engineering. You can't really go too far afield from what a bicycle looks like and behaves like now and still get one that's satisfactory in every way.
Chalo Colina is a machine designer with Blue Operations, a private space program in Seattle.
I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my bicycle.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and our cover story this week is fathers. Bobby McFerrin is a father of two sons, one of whom is named Taylor.
That's correct.
The other is named...
Javon.
And a daughter.
Madison.
And they're all musical as well.
Right.
You certainly know Bobby McFerrin from his song, Don't Worry, Be Happy, the gigantic global hit of 1988. During the past 14 years, he's created an entire musical world for himself. He's conducted orchestras, including his own vocal group called the Voicestra. He's recorded with Yo-Yo Ma, and he's continued to improvise solo vocal music across all genres. Bobby McFerrin's newest album is called Beyond Words. Bobby, this is Father's Day weekend. You had a father.
Yeah.
What was he like?
Well, when I was growing up, I didn't see my dad that much. His career was really beginning to take off. You know, he was singing. He was one of the few sort of recognized African-American opera singers. And when I was about five, he made his debut with the Metropolitan Opera. And then his career started to take off. So as an artist, he was absolutely phenomenal. He was a fantastic teacher. I've never seen a teacher that I thought was as passionate and strict. He was very strict.
With you or with his students?
With his students, with his students. Oh, he was very strict with us kids, too. He could be very, very stern.
You actually collaborated with your father on a piece of music in 1990.
That would be
Discipline.
Right, Discipline. My father had a stroke in 88. And I remember the session very well because he'd learn a line and then he would forget it. So we had to sort of, you know, keep doing the same line over and over and over and over again. I think we took about 4 hours to do it. But it was wonderful, wonderful, wonderful to have his voice. His voice on my album.
Bring up your feeble hearts, bring up your wicked knees. Fix your mind on things above, above where he is king, above where he is king. Bring up your feeble hearts, bring up your wicked knees. Set your heart on things above, above where we will be, above where we will be.
All those who have been trained by it notice a plan, seem pleasant at the time, but painful. Notice a plan, seem pleasant at the time, but painful.
That was Robert McFerrin Sr. and Bobby McFerrin Jr. singing together on Discipline. I assume it was no accident that you chose to sing with your stern, classical father a song called Discipline?
I don't really know. I don't remember what the thought process was for having him do it. I think that at the time, I might have been thinking, you know, he hasn't been singing that much. He hasn't had the opportunity to do a lot of singing since his stroke, and I wanted to, before he was gathered to his people, you know, before he died, I wanted to make sure that we had a chance to do some work together.
What did he think of the music you make?
He liked it. He liked it very much. He couldn't understand how I did what I did, but
technically, right?
Yeah, he couldn't quite grasp it. As a matter of fact, I was just reminded of a time that we actually did a concert together in Germany, in Berlin, but I don't remember the year. It was in the early 80s, and we did, one of the pieces that we did was the Bach Gounod Ave Maria, and I sang the Bach part, and he sang the Ave Maria, and I remember that we had to practice it over and over and over again, only because he wanted to make sure that he heard what I was singing, you know, because on piano, it's, you know, you just sort of used to that sound, you know. But having my, you know, the Bach part sung was unusual for him. And so, but then that's true to form because my father rehearsed a lot. He sang a lot, you know. He was very studious that way.
You've collaborated with your own son, Taylor, on your latest record.
Yeah.
He's in college?
Right, New School University. and in New York City.
He plays the beatbox on a song called Tailor Made.
All right.
Can we listen to that?
Sure.
Let's do.
Sure.
Can you explain to us in that piece of music what the different tracks we're hearing are?
Well, Taylor is doing all the vocal percussion, you know, the... I can't do it. whatever it was he was doing, you know, I don't quite have the same kind of technique. So he's doing all the vocal percussion, and then there's, you know, I've got some vocal tracks that I added on, and then the band is playing Chick Corea and Richard Bona and Omar Hakim.
It must be chastening to have a son who can do something musically that you can't really quite do.
Well, that's the way it's supposed to be. I mean, every generation, they're supposed to take what you do, you know, as a foundation and build on it. I mean, that's the order of things. I think it goes way, way back because I know that the music that I do is generations times generations old. You know, because I'm convinced that that all of our brains have sort of these memories that we can't even tap into unless we somehow access them through one way or another. I think I do through improvisation. You know, I sort of go to this place because we're all made up out of the memories of our ancestors. You know, I'm made up out of the memory of my father, he was created out of the memory of his father and so on and so on. So there must be this lineage of thinking and thoughts and all that sort of like are in here, you know. And I think that we can, all of us have access to them if we find how to do it, you know. And usually artists, I think, are very, very good at doing that because a lot of what they do is sort of from a part of their brain that they call upon for the muse to express themselves, to, you know, just to come out, you know. And that's what happens.
That's Bobby McFerrin. I'm Kurt Anderson. In a minute, an 8-year-old boy hunts for the shadowy subtext in his father's photographs. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and we're talking today about fathers. Throughout today's show, we're going to hear from some creative people about their own fathers. Here's the comedian Janine Garofalo.
Hi, this is Janine Garofalo, and when I think of my dad, I think of oranges. My father always would travel the extra mile for his kids in every way. And my dad knew that I loved oranges. And he would frequently, without me asking or even if I did ask, peel me oranges at night while I would be watching. I was allowed 1 hour of television after dinner. And he would go to great lengths to make sure there was not a trace of white schmutz on the orange because he knew that I didn't like any white on my orange. And he would sit there almost like a sculptor or like someone working on scrimshaw with a knife peeling this orange to perfection, and the orange would be completely pristine and devoid of white. Happy Father's Day, Carmine Garofalo.
Janine Garofalo talking about her father. In a few minutes, we'll talk again with my guest, Bobby McFerrin, But first, we have a story about a collaboration between a photographer and his very young son. Thomas Roma photographs scenes of everyday life in churches, in courthouses, on streets, in people's living rooms. 2 years ago, he asked his 8-year-old son, Giancarlo, to imagine the stories behind some of his photographs. Giancarlo sorted through a huge stack of his dad's pictures and wrote about the ones that he liked best. His essays and Roma's photographs have been published together in a book called Show and Tell. Hilary Frank spent an afternoon in Brooklyn at their home with Thomas and Giancarlo Roma.
We've always done father and son things, whether it's thinking of building a rocket ship, building a go-kart, or this. We've always wanted to do something together.
From the beginning, I thought that this might be an opportunity for Giancarlo to get to know me in a way that I couldn't say in words. And I had a friend who was 56 years old, and he died suddenly. And it came as such a shock to me that I was confronted with my mortality in a new way. He was just about my age. And I had realized that Giancarlo had just became old enough where if I did die, he would remember me. You know, some nut screaming for his wife, saying, "Where's my wallet? You know, where's my keys? You know, I'm late for work. You know, what could I do? Sit down with him and say, you know, Dad's afraid of dying, and this is what you should know about me." And I realized that most of whatever I'm about, I'm not in touch with anyway. but hopefully it's in our work somewhere.
Thomas pulled out a huge box of his old pictures and gave them to his son. He didn't tell Giancarlo that he wanted this to be a bonding experience. Giancarlo immediately approached the project as if he was hunting for clues about his father. In his essays, it's almost like he's solving a crime. He'll notice things like a wedding ring being on a guy's right hand instead of his left, which he decides must mean the picture was taken in a mirror. He clearly has a love for art, which he describes in his intro to the book as a hungry, choked-up feeling. Here's Giancarlo reading from his essay entitled The Lost Umbrella.
The tilted umbrella creates a polygon-shaped shadow that looks as if it can fill the empty part of the sky that the trees make. You can see it better if you squint.
Was that something that occurred to you, Tom, when you took the picture, that the darkness of the umbrella and the shadow could fill in the light there?
Boy, I don't think in a million years I thought that. I was so thrilled that he did. And I think that word polygon is something you probably learned in school that year or the year before. So I was even shocked to hear it referred to as a specific shape. It's the way I hope people experience pictures whole, and that a shadow is just as much substance as the thing. And he saw that.
Can we turn to the one of the dad and the son with their heads on the counter?
Yeah.
Okay. First, can you read it?
Okay. Whenever a father does something around his 3, 4, or 5-year-old, the child will usually copy him. When I was little, that's what I did. I think the dad is a fireman because he has a mug with number 1, fire. You can't see the AN on the other side. There are bills on the counter, and he's looking through the classifieds. Maybe he can't pay all the bills, and he's looking for another job. There's a piece of classified torn off on the counter. It could be a job that he might want. The drapes behind them make a beautiful triangle shape above their heads, and there's a wedding picture hung next to them on the wall that shows a happier time in the dad's life. This picture showing a father with a young child resting their heads on their arms makes me want to cry.
When I read that one, I thought, those are such adult thoughts that you're having. And it was really surprising to me. Do you ever feel like you're thinking more like an adult than like a kid?
Sometimes. Yeah, and sometimes it bothers me a little bit because I'm thinking, you know, too far ahead of time, or I'm thinking about all the things that can go wrong instead of right. But, yeah, it occurs to me sometimes.
I think Giancarlo is a very special boy. But I also think people underestimate children. And as special as he is, the main thing about the book is he was given an opportunity to write about his own feelings. He was encouraged. He was treated as a peer, as a colleague. And just like any collaboration, sometimes there was friction. But it's mostly because I expected a lot of him. So I'm not sure if it's exactly that it's an adult. I think what he writes like is he writes as if he's a child whose feelings and opinions are valued.
I got to see my dad's world, and some were sad pictures, and some were happy, and I think he did the same thing as I did with about writing them as he did taking them. He was in different phases at different times, and that made him think differently about what pictures he took. His feelings, they don't control his heart, but his art, but they affect it in a way.
I think this book is certainly a landmark for us. He's going to be able to look at this after I'm gone, or maybe 20 years from now I'll still be around and we'll be able to sit around and we could discuss how it not only marked what we were for each other, but how it changed us.
And do you feel that way too, that you have a deeper understanding of your father now?
Definitely. I have much better understanding of him. And if he was to die, I would definitely remember him for this in every picture.
We have our fingers crossed, though.
For Studio 360, I'm Hillary Frank.
To see some of Thomas Roma's photographs and read Giancarlo's descriptions of them, visit our website, studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the musician Bobby McFerrin, and we're talking about creativity and fatherhood. Bobby, what did you think of that project?
I think it's a wonderful idea. You know, one of the things that I really enjoy doing is going to my children's classes, you know, when they were young, particularly my daughter, because for some reason she has been sort of the champion of me doing this, and that's going to school and reading stories or making up stories for her class, you know. So that's something that we actually do together, though it's not a project like, you know, doing a book together.
The 8-year-old boy Giancarlo's writing sounded, some of it is very serious and even sort of dark. Does one want to hear that kind of thinking from an eight-year-old?
And the answer, I think, is yes and no. The answer is yes because of the world that we live in, I think, nowadays is a little bit more dangerous, you know. And the other is regrettably... I think kids are growing up too fast. Their minds are being crammed with too much information too soon. And I think that's really unfair. I think that kids need to not worry so much about what adults are worrying about nowadays. You know, I think that's what's happening. A lot of the kids are taking on our own anxieties.
You say you go to your 10-year-old's school and make up stories and tell stories, and you've worked with your older son. Obviously, you are good at trying to be both a father and a, you know, world famous entertainer. But is that hard? Has that been hard in the last 10 or 15 years?
It's had its moments of tremendous difficulty and strain. In the beginning, I didn't know how to balance my career and my family life, and so I was home very little say 14 years ago, especially when Don't Worry, Be Happy was very, very big. I think at that point I was home maybe 4 months a year. And I wish I could take all that back. You know, I wish I could I had sort of figured out before that time exactly what to do, but I didn't really have sort of my own personal disciplines. They weren't strong enough for me to, you know, really buckle down and say, no, I can't do this, I can't do that. But, you know, Don't Worry, I'm glad that that happened. I'm glad that Don't Worry happened because I saw what fame can do. You know, I went to that place where everybody wants a piece of you, you know. And it happened at a very good time because when Don't Worry was really peaking, I was getting more and more burnt out. And just when you think you'd want to tour Don't Worry, Be Happy to Death, I took an 18-month sabbatical at a very critical time because I figured if I didn't do it then and I sort of let, you know, the record company, you know, the powers, the entertainment powers that be have their way with me, I would have destroyed my family life, I think. And the reason that I was, the reason that it was so easy was because 3 days before my sabbatical began, I took a picture of myself with a Polaroid camera at an airport getting ready to get on a plane. You know, I had 3 days to go. And so I took this Polaroid picture, and I mean, you could see the bags under my eyes. You could see my shoulders sagging. You could see that I was very unhappy. I was, you know, I was so burnt out. And I put this picture by my phone. I put it by the phone. So when anybody would call me up and say, you know, could you do this for me? You know, I just look at the photo and realize that the answer was no, you know, no matter how attractive it was. You know, Warren Beatty called and said, you know, I want you to play 88 in the movie Dick Tracy, and I'm willing to come up there and talk to you about it, you know, stuff like that. I looked at that, took one look at that picture, and I said, no, can't do it. Can't do it.
The vocalist and composer and conductor, Bobby McFerrin, is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. We're talking about fathers. Our next story is about using art to understand your father better. In 1999, the choreographer Robin Harris began making a, quote, poetic documentary about a 35-day adventure that her father had taken in his youth. Producer Ian Chillig is Robin Harris's nephew and has the story.
These are the ways people would describe my grandfather. When he bathed in the lake. He could build anything. He drank. And when he was a boy, he took a canoe from Logan, West Virginia, to New Orleans. In 1941, Bob Harris, my grandfather, and his friend Tom Orr followed the Guyandot River to the Ohio River, to the Mississippi River, and south to the Gulf of Mexico. They were greeted as heroes everywhere they stopped. They grabbed onto barges and hitchhiked. Once they almost drowned.
After going around bend after bend, we landed at the Presbyterian Church camp at 12 o'clock, just in time to accept a luncheon invitation. We were asked to pose for pictures and to sign autograph books. Once in a lifetime this happens. Take advantage of it.
The trip is bigger than life in my family. In 1999, my aunt, Robin Harris, choreographed a dance about it called 30 and 73.
On the trip, they acted as newspaper correspondents to their hometown newspaper. So all along the way, they would write and send the stories home to their newspaper. And that those newspaper articles, in my work, ended up sort of chronicling the journey and being the sort of the structural device of the work. They would talk about in their log, you know, these, you know, near-death experiences, and then they would also talk about, you know, how bright the moon was. And, you know, and I love sort of the contrast between telling stories about really interesting, you know, sort of exciting things, and then just the sort of simple things.
He lived a long life, and people change over those lives. And do you see things in here that you didn't see during your life that you would want to see in him? Are there parts of this 17-year-old version of your father that you miss?
I regret that he didn't stay as happy as he seemed at this time. We had a house on a lake in West Virginia. And for fun, my father would, I think, put gasoline on the surface of the water. And I'm not sure how wide a span of gasoline that was. And then light the gasoline, and there would be fire. And he would have the children jump off the dock, swim under the fire, and come out on the other side. You know, I think the irony of his always being concerned about the rules we, his children, followed. I mean, we had to follow a lot of rules for safety. He didn't want us to be in danger, in spite of creating games for us to play under water on fire. I mean, there was this contradiction. But I mean, I think he was probably in enough dangerous situations himself that if he saw us recreating a situation he had been in at one time, that's probably when he, you know, it became alarming for him.
Here we are again, readers, bringing to you what we can now call a real hair-raising tale of our adventures during the past week. Thanks to the towboat, MT Twin Cities, we are able to be this far today and alive to write this article. Probably neither of us will really realize how close we did come to meeting instant death last Sunday when our canoe was overturned by the waves from that boat about 40 miles below Helena, Arkansas. It was last
30
Sunday
and
afternoon.
73 is an old newspaper term that was used when journalists, reporters sent in their articles and they wanted to indicate that that's all there was. It's sort of an over and out. When I found that out, it became this wonderful metaphor for that's all there is in a lifetime. That's it. That's the end.
When Bob died in 1998, Robin didn't know what to say at his funeral. It was over the next year that she created this dance as a kind of eulogy.
She stands on the very tip of the canoe and does a lot of balancing work that's hard to do, then it's risky, and it brings in that idea of the risk that they took on the trip and the risk that a person takes throughout life. There's swimming material that starts to grow, and it's very connected to the breath, and, you know, there's sort of the suggestion of the last breath through the swimming material. It starts to get, it kind of takes a beautiful and serious twist at that point in the piece. You know, I was thinking, God, it'd be so beautiful to do it in water, to see this piece actually in water. And then I just got this idea, like, wouldn't it be cool to, since we can't put the boat in water, to put water in the boat? And I really didn't think the dancers would be very excited about it. And, you know, I mentioned it to them, and they were just like, yes, we want to do this. And that just, you know, that really changed everything. One woman sort of dives over the shoulders of the other women, and she comes forward, and the feeling state of that is sort of, this is my life, you know. And I think after my dad found out he had these 5 brain tumors, he said, I think I've had it. I think I've had it, you know. And to realize you're going to die, you know, die soon, and he didn't know it much before that, I thought about how desperate that must feel. And the section itself is sort of this journey where you know, he knows, they know where they're going in a way, and that this is it. This is the last journey.
Robin Harris is director of the North Carolina State University Dance Program. An excerpt from 30 and 73 was performed last month at the Kennedy Center in Washington. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the musician Bobby McFerrin. In a minute, a young writer deals with the disconcerting ways that her artist father painted her. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. My guest is Bobby McFerrin, the vocalist and conductor. We're talking about fathers. Here is the writer and comedian Al Franken talking about his.
Hi, it's Al Franken. You know, when I think of my dad on Father's Day, I think of half-digested tuna casserole in a mustache. When I was about, I think, in 15 years old, like in 10th grade, one day in school, I ate some tuna casserole, and I think it might have been bad. That was our lunch. And when I came home, I was really felt nauseous and sick, so I just went to bed. And my dad would come home around 6 o'clock every night from work. And he came home, and he said to my mom, "Where's Alan?" And she said, "Well, he's in his bedroom, and he's not feeling very well." And Dad, a very always loving, concerned dad, walked in. And just as he came in, I had to throw up. So I just kind of jumped out of bed and almost falling down. And he kind of caught me kneeling down a little bit. And I threw up right in his face. And my dad had a mustache. So a lot of this sort of stayed on him, particularly on the mustache. And yet he didn't blink an eye, and he took me to the bathroom and sort of made sure that I was cleaned up before he cleaned up his face and his mustache. And that, to me, is the mark of a loving dad.
The comedian and writer Al Franken. We're listening to stories about fathers today in Studio 360. The writer Caitlin Shetterly grew up always in the gaze of a father who was a painter and a mother who was a writer. Both parents used their daughter as a subject. Caitlin is still figuring out what that experience told her about herself and about her parents.
I'm looking right now at a drawing my father did on newsprint of my foot next to his. He's written our names underneath each foot. The date of the drawing is 3/27/88. I was 13. The strange thing about this drawing is that our feet look like they are about the same size. My foot is pudgy, almost like it has baby fat. Do feet have baby fat? And his is more sinewy, with visible veins and thin, delicate toes like his mother, my grandmother, Bertie. This is the only drawing I know of where my dad put us both in the same composition. However, this kind of detailed drawing of me, or part of my body, my brother, my mother, or our pets, this was where my dad got his raw material to use later in abstracted and often surreal paintings of people and animals. Modeling for my dad was normal for us, and in some ways I think I, at least, liked the attention. I knew I was being seen. But sometimes his acute eye would make me feel exposed. When I see the drawings now of those years when I changed from a child to an adolescent to a pubescent, my self-consciousness comes flooding back to me. I remember how he accentuated my underbite, a feature I was teased about in school and later had corrected, or how my high forehead looked glacial, or how strange the teepee shapes of my incipient breasts seemed to me. By the time my parents divorced, half a decade later, my relationship to their work and me in it changed. Their work began to include the internal struggle of the marriage, the divorce, new relationships, and lovers. I was no longer the subject or the muse. My dad's paintings, suddenly, it seemed, had women in them I could not recognize, and often I did not want to, so I averted my gaze. Similarly, my junior year in college, I traveled to see my mother read fiction for the first time ever, and for that matter, fiction that had a sex scene. As I listened, I believed I knew who the man was, and I knew it was not my father, but a man she had had a brief relationship with a year or two after the divorce, a man who I had never met and could only imagine. And of course, I assumed that she was the woman in the story. As the story in my mind imitated what I believed was her now private personal life, I began to sweat profusely and then threw up in the bathroom outside the auditorium. But none of this was her fault, nor were my father's revealing paintings his. They were just being artists, I understand now, exploring their lives and crossing the line from reality into fiction. At the time, I could not see where one began and the other ended because I did not know anymore. For my last birthday, my father gave me a large painting called The Birthday. In it, I seem to have reappeared in his work. It is of a young girl in pigtails whose mother is pinning a mask on her face to protect her, I think, from the adult world that awaits her, from pain that will inevitably come. But the thing is, I can't look at this painting and just see the story. The girl looks exactly like me, the woman like my mother, and it's touching and unnerving that my father painted this long after we stopped being a family, long after my mother could shield me from anything, most of all the pain of my parents' divorce. So, for almost a year, I kept the painting in a large, flat cardboard box, leaned up against the wall in my apartment hallway. Last week, my father visited on his way through town, and I took it out. I began to see things in the composition I hadn't let myself see before. A swab of baby blue on the little girl's ear, and then that same blue accentuates her mask in a tiny half-moon sliver. I saw the delicate yellow of the ribbon that holds back the girl's red-brown hair. There was something about hanging it together. My dad's strong 6'1" body next to mine, protecting me, in a sense, like the mother in the painting tries to do, that made it unmistakably mine.
The writer Caitlin Shetterly's short story collection, Fault Lines, Stories of Divorce, was published last fall. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. My guest is the performer Bobby McFerrin. We're talking about fathers.
I was a little unnerved by that piece, being a writer who has, in one instance in a novel I wrote, stole one of my daughter's life and things she said so completely and used it. And although she hasn't read this book because she's barely 12, she perpetually accuses me of having stolen her material. And I do wonder when she's able to come on radio and tell sad stories about how I dealt with her, how I will come across.
Well, you know, it'll be interesting to know. It'll be interesting to see how my kids are on stage. You know, when they reach the point where they're professionals and they're performing, whether in musicals or they have some kind of a solo career.
And you expect all of them will?
And I think all of them will, yeah. I don't have really any doubt. And so it'll be interesting to see what part of me is there, you know, what it actually looks like, how they've sort of decoded my method, whatever, and sort of taken that part of me and use it, you know, because I know my father had a wonderful way on stage. I probably get my ease and comfort on stage from him because he was the very same way. You know, he could, as soon as he walked out on stage, all of a sudden you felt very comfortable. And even when he messed up, he would make something out of it. Because I remember once when he was performing at the Hollywood Bowl with the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra, and he was singing some aria, and he made a mistake. And just sort of the moment of sort of realization and how he handled himself, you know, with such grace. You know, there's some performers who will just sort of, you know, they'll go, "Ah, I messed up," you know, whatever.
Really? I've never actually heard that exactly.
No, probably not. You wouldn't see, but you can feel it. You know, all of a sudden you're on the edge of your seat, you know. You know something is wrong, and because they're screaming inside, "Oh, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? What am I going to do?" But Dad had this way of just sort of like making a mistake, and it was like, okay, you know, I made a mistake, no big deal. I sort of got that from him, I think.
Which is the joy, of course, of live performance, is seeing how performers deal with those inevitable flaws and mistakes.
Right, yeah.
Has being a father of these children, do you think, changed how you practice your craft, change how you teach or conduct or perform?
Well, it changes you, which changes everything. I mean, the moment you become a father, everything changes. Everything does. And, you start thinking about everything you do and the impact that it has on your kids, even the things that your kids might not even know about you, you know, the stuff that's yours. Good stuff, bad stuff, whatever it is, good habits, bad habits, whatever. It impacts on your kids in ways, in profound ways that you're probably not even aware of. And so once you have kids, you start thinking about everything you do, everything. you know, at least I did. I would imagine that you couldn't help but think about what you're doing with your life.
I think that's right. Although it strikes me that kids, having now had two of them and gotten them halfway to adulthood, that they are more like pieces of music that somebody else wrote that I'm just sort of helping realize. The sense that one creates one's children in that sense from a blank slate, I think is, in my view, is misguided. I think we're just pushing along these creatures that plop out into our homes.
Pushing along, well, I don't know. I don't know if we're pushing them along. That means they're in front of us if we do that.
Well, I think we're just doing the best we can.
We are certainly doing the best we can.
We're more like interpretive artists than creative artists in a certain way, if you can apply that paradigm to children.
Yeah, I wish, I'm sure every parent says this, that I wish I knew more than I did when I had my first kid. You know, I wish that I was just a more centered kind of person.
You seem like the most centered person in the world.
Well, I'm not. But I wish that I had been a lot more stricter with myself. You know, you can't be strict with your kids unless you're strict with yourself. You know, you can't tell your kids not to do something if you're doing it. You can't. You start checking out everything that you do. And it's an amazing responsibility. And I wish that I had known somehow the kind of responsibility I had before I actually became a father.
No,
I wish I was more grown up somehow.
Bobby McFerrin, thank you for joining me today in Studio 360.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Bobby McFerrin is the son of the late, great opera singer Robert McFerrin Sr. and the father of Taylor, Javon, and Madison McFerrin. His new album is called Beyond Words. To find out more about Bobby or any other McFerrin, or about any of the stories you've heard on the program today, visit our website, studio360.org. At the beginning of today's show, I spoke about fathers on stage and in film and on television. So what about fathers in radio? To close the show today, Studio 360's Jocelyn Gonzalez spent some time with two experts on the subject, my daughters, Kate and Lucy Anderson, who weighed in on yours truly, starting in a record and video shop, shopping for a Father's Day gift.
No. Kate, that one looks terrible. What are you talking about? That means that's something that you would like. I don't think Dad would like that.
You might,
Wow.
Sometimes he plays around, like, if we're listening to K-Rock in the car or something.
He
starts headbanging and pretending, you know, he's rocking out. Or if he's rapping, he goes, like, you know, with the hand movements and the et cetera, et cetera.
There's some music that we, like, I don't know, not really negative criticism exactly, because he can't blame us for what the type of music that we like, but he'll just point out that, you know, like, this is interesting music in a sarcastic way.
Yeah, like, Dad kind of snorts at things when he doesn't like them. Like, just like, you know, this isn't music, but he never actually says that.
He might think it's too loud, or like, maybe, not like he's in, I don't want to sound like he's in some old man, because he's not exactly. He kind of likes 50s, you know, old music. Like, we have a lot of Billie Holiday CDs and all these kind of deep women and men. Like Frank Sinatra and all those kind of classics. I think we also like a lot of indie movies. A Beautiful Mind, Amelie, because, you know, it's an indie movie. Moulin Rouge, maybe.
Blade 2, especially the kind of thing. Also less, like, sexual things in movies and more violence. Violence is the thing they, at least Dad, I think, is the most not wanting us to be. Like, it's really, really violent. He'll probably be a little iffish about us seeing it. But
if it's like sexuality or whatever, he might think we'll feel uncomfortable because, you know, like, so what do you think of the movie? It's like, you know, it was good. He's kind of spaces out some, but not in a negative, bad way, just kind of a child, like, cute kind of way. It's like nice way.
He doesn't get angry that often, so, you know. It's not like so much
criticism when it comes to things he likes but things he does. And I guess there's somewhat of a perfectionist in him in that case, but...
Which isn't a bad thing. But I think he really kind of needs to loosen up and just kind of... I mean, criticism is really more of a helping thing. It's like, if somebody criticizes you, they're trying to help you to perform, you know, better and do a better job.
That's fun to be with, because, like, when people talk about our family, I guess they end up comparing me to my dad slightly more, because dad's kind of, like, go with the flow, slowish in a way, and Lucy and mom are more high-strung and organized. There's good qualities and bad qualities to both, because dad and I end up being late and procrastinating and end up staying up really late, and Lucy and mom end up, like, caring, like, about every little detail.
So. It's like, you want to do well. I mean, I don't want every single quality or flaw. Because my dad has flaws, you know. Everybody has flaws, and you'd prefer not to have flaws. But seeing that he has few flaws, if I was similar to him in his characteristics, I'd be very happy with that.
My daughters, Kate and Lucy, are 14 and 12, respectively. They will never be allowed to move away, and they are aspiring artists and writers who live in Brooklyn. Our piece was produced by Jocelyn Gonzalez. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Jocelyn Gonzalez,
Steve Nelson,
Michelle Siegel,
Lital Mulad,
Andy Lancet,
Jared Alexander,
Sarah Lilly,
Lou Olkowski,
Michael Rayfield.
The music is by David Van Tegum. Special thanks to Philadelphia's WHYY. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is a co-production of Public Radio International and WNYC New York, and is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Tiffany & Company Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, Cheech Marin on collecting.
Various painters came up with that name for me. They call me De Medicheech now. I mean, when I stand in front of a Chicano painting, it was like, it's really an emotional experience. Like, wow, is that cool? You know, I mean, it's real basic, you know. They're like having my friends around. They talk to me.
Cheech Marin, next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.